Good morning. We have an open rules petition conference, and we have a public hearing on Rule Petition 1401, creation of 80986, crime victim privacy, filed in January of this year by Ms. Southwick on behalf of the Wisconsin Judicial Council. And we have, presenting this is Judge Brian Blanchard of the Court of Appeals on behalf of the council. And I have the following appearances noted: April Southwick, Jill Karofsky, Gregory Weber, Talisa Tishnor, Rachel Monica Wilcox. If anyone else wishes to appear when the marshal returns, you please give her your name. So, Judge Blanchard.
Justice and members of the court, it's my pleasure to represent the council in this petition. I was the former chair of the appellate section when we worked on this, and I'm now vice chair of the Judicial Council. As you know, this is an attempt to protect the privacy of victims, victims of crime, and there's a definition you've seen in terms of what a victim is, working heavily off Chapter 950, in opinions and briefs at the appellate level. And the ultimate concern here was complaints from victims themselves who've been in the situation of essentially searches on the Internet using, say, a first name. Some first names, of course, are more unique than others. But in any case, a first name, perhaps a last initial, and there would be the first entry in Google, might be an opinion of the Court of Appeals or the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So the committee spent a great deal of time crafting this language, and we hope it's acceptable to the court. I know you have Attorney Southward's letter of September 2nd addressing two particular questions that had come from the court. This would be a final new rule of the Rules of Appellate Procedure. So 80986 would essentially stand alone as its own rule addressing, again, what should be, what shouldn't be in briefs, and then appellate court opinions. As the commentary reflects, the committee was very mindful of the distinction between what happens in the circuit court and the necessity, or at least at this stage, the practice of reference to victims by full names or some other way, both in complaints and police reports, affidavits, et cetera. And we were mindful of that difference, that this, at least in the intent in drafting it, would be not to affect that at all. It really would be just at the appellate level a rule that would govern those submitting briefs and the judges, the courts themselves, in issuing opinions. So that's a very brief overview. I know you have several speakers, including Attorney Southworth. I'm happy to take any general questions now or as you proceed.
Honorable Judge Blanchard, I do have a couple of questions regarding the content of the petition. Are they more likely more appropriate to ask Attorney Southwick in terms of the details of the petition?
That'd be fine, and I'm happy to join in if that would be helpful.
Okay.
I'm just going to mention now so others can think about it. There is a ad hoc committee on confidentiality and redaction that the Committee of Chief Judges has. And they are circulating for comment a proposal that would come to the court protecting sensitive information in court records, but it deals with the trial courts,
yes,
not appellate reports. And, of course, once there's redaction or appropriate designation in the trial court, then it would become pretty automatic
right.
at the appellate court. So this, of course, is not in final form, and I don't pretend that I know well all of the provisions in it, but I did not see a conflict or problem. But if anyone else does, I would appreciate their commenting.
Thank you.
Judge Blanchard.
That's my understanding as well.
Okay. Thank you. Good. All right. There are no further questions.
Well,
Justice Prosser.
Are there any exceptions to this rule?
Well, there's sub 4, of course, is quite broad, and it allows for essentially protective orders in either direction from the Court of Appeals. That is the approach of this rule, is to allow parties to say more than they think the rule might allow for, or to require the other side to say less.
That's subsection 4 that we're talking about.
And there was a question that's addressed by Attorney Southworth on this. One of the main areas, Justice Prosser, that has come up as a question, and the court had it too, is who else might readily fall in protection? One would be witnesses. So this defines victim of a crime. It's not hard to imagine a witness, particularly a child witness, where some of these exact same issues would bubble up quickly. But instead of trying to go more broadly to sweep witnesses in as a default, what the rule does is, as it's drafted now, is to point toward a motion, for example, on a witness.
Are there exceptions that you can think of for victims?
Well, the only one built into the rule is homicide cases. But other than that, it's, I believe, left to sub 4, sort of motion practice. And one thing I just point out for context, we spend some time as a committee thinking about, there are certainly cases you can think of them, family law cases, restraining orders, that aren't criminal cases in which there are very sensitive issues. There are crimes being described. To keep it clean, to put it simply, this is defined to be criminal cases. So thinking of exceptions, one way of thinking about it is, well, there's big exceptions, so for various types of civil cases are not covered. That's sub 1 in defining the types of cases was attempting to zero in on criminal-type cases.
What about juvenile cases? Are they automatically taken care of?
I'm
juvenile
sorry.
Cases.
Correct. This does not affect juvenile.
I assume that, although I did not check every statute, that they're covered by confidentiality rules in the juvenile
chapter. And I think that rule says first name, last initial. I think that specifically addresses.
Suppose a prominent public official was a victim of crime. Suppose the mayor of Milwaukee was the subject of battery, and it led to some sort of appellate proceeding. Are you seriously suggesting that the name of the victim should not be in the opinion?
Correct. It wouldn't, unless a party were to make a motion to say there's some reason that calls either in the briefing, or I guess in theory a motion could be about opinions, but I guess we're typically contemplating at the briefing stage, new document created for appellate purposes, brief. Here's why, dear Court of Appeals, we should or need or it makes sense to refer to this public official. The discussion we had in the committee had to do with when might an advocate feel that they can't be effective unless they use a full name or enough of a name. And the example we came up with was not so much a public official, that's another interesting kind of example, was where the name itself somehow bears on an issue, maybe a nickname that has violence attached to it, and it's a self-defense case. That's one that people tended to think of. And again, that's the way it's now drafted. Sub 4 is the avenue to address those kind of cases.
I think I heard you say something about a motion. Who makes the motion?
Actually, it's quite broad. For good cause, the court may make any order necessary to protect the identity of victim or other person or excuse compliance, may make any order, and I believe the commentary, or no, maybe it was in April Southworth's letter, talked about the contemplation of the committee that this could be...
Should the words on motion be added there?
Well, I'll just say, maybe that's what the court would like to do. I'll just say our thinking was to keep that actually sort of as broad as possible. Sua sponte, what if a victim, him or herself, wanted to submit a letter or pleading, whatever style it's in, to a court on this issue? I think the committee, at least the thought, the council, at least, we were thinking all the best to keep that broad.
Judge Blanchard, did this particular rule come from complaints from a number of victims?
Correct. And I think Ms. Kurofsky was prepared to address that today from Department of Justice. Absolutely. This did come from concerns from actual victims who had believed they'd been affected by, and of course, no suggestion there was any intent to hurt anyone, but in the course of just court opinions, making references that they felt that they had an impact on their lives from a reference to them by name.
And the feeling, I take it, was that this was something that was broad-based. In other words, a lot of us have done this during the course of writing opinions.
Yeah, maybe Ms. Kurofsky could address that. I certainly don't have any numbers in my head, but there were concrete people coming forward, yes.
All right, thank you.
Well, I will return then and ask you a question. The petition covers opinions and briefs. What about orders?
I'm just looking at the definition here. Opinion or decision. Opinion or decision. Trying to remember if we... I think there was some discussion around orders.
I don't know the answer. Perhaps another person who comes to the fore may be able to respond.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a good... And I'm not recovering whether we ever try to nail that down or what. That's maybe a good question.
One of the concerns I have is that it does, the scope of it right now is rather narrow and does not include other appellate filings. And yet I can envision other appellate filings being online as resources allow and technology certainly permits that. That's going to necessitate, as I see the petition now drafted, a request to come in on another petition. Isn't there some wording that can be proposed that would cover those eventualities that would negate the requirement that they come back in with a petition to amend the rule?
There's a lot of discussion about that, including discussion about the actual just technology. Excuse me. What does the clerk's office do when you go to the general court's webpage? What can you get to? And our understanding from talking with people there and actually just sitting and Googling ourselves and seeing what came up is that as things stand now, correct, it's opinions and briefs. That's through the website. It does appear on Google. But the thought was, yes, surely, we're only going in one direction on digital data, but the circuit courts and ultimately the appellate courts, and that it's likely that this would be brought back and there would be an attempt to revisit this if the courts comfortable with this basic approach, but then things change so that new sets of pleadings are available. A related concept that comes up a lot, though, is that the committee was very sensitive to the idea, again, on this idea that circuit court records are, at least at this stage, a very different animal, in that appendices, records in general, a name might appear thousands of times. And we were concerned about just the practical reality. So when we come to a day when these other filings, and that's your focus here, these other filings are readily available on the Internet, I think it may be that the Judicial Council may be back to revisit as to that aspect. We just sort of had to do a line somewhere, and that's where we put the line.
That's understandable. My sense is, as these other filings likely will become available, your concern about privacy interests will be compromised because there necessarily will be a lag time. These documents will become available, then you meet and you have a group that decides, after much study, to file a petition to amend, and then the petition is scheduled for a hearing such as this, and then ultimately there may be an order amending, but that, of course, will be months or a year or so, and in the meantime, the very evil, if you will, that you want to address is occurring.
Understood, and actually, but we did discuss it at that level. Now, the hope would be that next time around this would be more abbreviated on the thinking part. I mean, we spent a lot of time trying to just define the universe. What's a victim? How do you define them? Depending on what the court wants to do, of course, at this stage, at least we've kind of been over that ground, and some of that would be, we'd be able to move much more quickly, hopefully.
The next petition may just be a kind of formal one in the sense that the basic decision has been made and doesn't need a hearing, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe.
Mm-hmm. What about the word pseudonym? The state bar took objection to the use of that word.
Yes. So the pseudonym can be seen as a fictitious name, and that I think the state bar kind of focused on that, understandably enough. You look at some dictionary definitions, and it means Jane Roe or Victoria for victim. And that is one way to read the rule, that pseudonym means that, and it's allowed along with initials. But if you're going to describe somebody as the child, the neighbor, whatever, some other word, that I think is not covered. That is not prohibited in any way by that. That's not a name. That's a description of someone. So the thinking here is you've got initials and then you've got pseudonyms. There's actually that definition, the word pseudonym can, I think, in many uses, be a little broader than just fictitious name. And so either way, in other words, if you look at it either as only fictitious name, then that's fine. We've still got descriptors. Or if you think of the word pseudonym as being broader and pulling in other, it would also be covered here. So there was a lot of discussion on the committee initially was, should we just have a rule that says you have to say victim one, victim two, victim three? And there was a lot of resistance to that among practitioners, people thinking that that limits their ability to be effective advocates. And that's so out of that discussion came this wording, which we think works. So in other words, just to summarize on the pseudonym business, it allows fictitious names like Victoria for victim, but also does not prohibit a descriptor like the child or the neighbor.
Well, the bar said, why don't you just grammatically use the word other appropriate designation, use the word designation rather than pseudonym. Does the committee object to that?
And the difference, maybe Attorney Southworth might have some very helpful comments on that. In my own mind, the difference is maybe not that great if you take particular examples.
Right. We'll wait until we hear from Ms. Southworth.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
Could I give you an unrealistic hypothetical? Suppose the Court of Appeals issued an opinion that was contrary to this rule. What is the consequence of that?
I don't have a ready answer. It's a rule of appellate procedure. We expect the courts to follow their rules. In this area, I have to say, the obvious, that once you've had a document that's already out of the barn, and there it is, it's maybe been on the Internet. My technical knowledge is pretty thin here, so I don't know about what would happen over time if there were an amended opinion that were issued by a court after that. In terms of sanctions or consequences, I don't remember that even coming up as part of the committee. I mean, courts, of course, can err, and they can violate their own rules. And that's brought to the attention of a court. At the very least, you have the ability of the aggrieved party to point to the rule. And I think here, just thinking out loud here with you, Justice, would be seeing if there could be, for example, an amended order.
Well, what about a motion for reconsideration? You take that now.
Yeah, and as to just issuing an amended order.
And then removing it.
Right.
Same thing would apply if and when this court would err. That's just as plausible, maybe more so, in your opinion.
Justice Prosser asks, ma'am.
Yes.
Justice Prosser asks the question of what's the consequence if the court takes a misstep with regard to this. What's the consequence, my question, if the person filing the appeal and the brief makes a misstep? Do you anticipate that the clerk of the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court, if it is noticed, I understand they don't intend to police it, but if it is noticed, would return that as a non-compliant filing?
I guess, and again, I don't remember any committee discussion on this, but just thinking about this with you, I guess I'd put this in the category of other rules. The courts get non-compliant briefs in various ways to different degrees regularly,
mm-hmm.
and I think it would be up to the court to decide. Just decide in the first instance, of course, if there's been a violation. There's going to be room for interpretation, I suppose, at the edges on some of this. And then if it's not compliant, yes, return it for. I would think return it for the filing of a replacement brief. In extreme circumstances, I suppose, as now, if it appeared to be an intentional or harassing type of step, that would be a rare special category. But right now we have rules that can be violated to greater or lesser degrees, and both the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court address that by trying to assess what's going on and what needs to be corrected.
Justice Prosser?
Well, I don't want to pick on the judge.
That's the problem with going first.
We have a case before the court right now, and I won't discuss that case. I will discuss the Court of Appeals' opinion in that case. And let me read part of this. In October 2006, the state filed a criminal complaint alleging that on September 27, 2006, the defendant, Gonzalez, while an inmate at the Milwaukee County Jail, assisted by several other inmates, attacked and severely beat fellow inmate Frederick Brown.
And that's the alleged offense in the case?
I beg your pardon?
That's the alleged offense in the case?
Uh-huh. That's the alleged offense in the case. I could go down a little bit. The central issue at trial was the identity of the inmates who attacked Brown. The state called several witnesses, including Brown, and then it talks about two Milwaukee deputies. The state called Brown to testify, but he proved to be a reluctant witness. Immediately upon taking the stand, he told the trial court, "I don't want to do this. several times throughout his testimony, he repeated to the trial court, I don't want to be here. Do this, man. Okay. Now, the way I read your rule is that Brown should be eliminated here.
Correct.
Completely.
Correct. It would be, it could be the inmate or the victim inmate, the victim. It could be, using the pseudonym idea, Jones, footnote, Jones is inmate, if, for those advocates who prefer that style. But correct, Brown would qualify as a victim of a crime.
What about the witness who doesn't want to testify?
Right, and the witness, if named, wouldn't, and that goes back unless someone moved for treatment on that issue. You know, and the spirit of this, you know, anticipates hopefully that both advocates and courts will be maybe more sensitive to this particular issue in our internet age than might have been a practice in the past. So when it comes to victim, I think under this rule, it would be still just a discretionary call as to whether to name victims or not. And at least many of us think in many cases there's no reason to use the name. The name is not relevant to any issue in the case.
Should the rule, and I ask this because I'd like others to address it too, or the comment indicate that the clerk does not have an obligation to read all of the appendices, I'm sorry, all of the briefs. It does read now the opinion, so, but doesn't have an obligation to enforce this rule. Now, the clerk's office does enforce any number of rules, but it's only when it's obvious, if you know what I mean, the caption is wrong. The clerk says, I'm not taking the brief, and they fix that page, and there are other ways that they enforce some of these rules, but not necessarily by reading. So I'm wondering whether that comment shouldn't be in. It is, the clerk's office did send a communication saying that it could not and would not read everything, but
right, and I don't remember a lot of discussion on that sort of enforcement aspect. At least in my own mind, I think we pictured, we did not necessarily picture the clerk's office reading each word, each line of a brief looking for this issue. I guess maybe that's the best question for the clerk in terms of resources and how they normally do it. In my own mind, it would probably be more likely noticed at the level where either, well, where a court or court staff were actually reading it. But then you raise an interesting issue about sort of the reality of what happens when the documents hit the clerk's office.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Thank you,
thank
Judge
you
Blanchard. Ms. Southwick?
Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. As you know, I'm here on behalf of the Wisconsin Judicial Council to ask the court to adopt proposed rule 80986. This morning, I am going to take a lesson from Judge Rick Stankovitz, and I'm going to keep my remarks very short, and then I will open it up to questions from the court. First, I would like to address the request from the appellate practice section of the State Bar. While they are in support of the rule, they have had a little bit of a concern about the use of the term pseudonym, and they have offered some alternate language. The council does not support their request for substituting alternate language there for two reasons. First, as Judge Blanchard already touched on, the rules as they exist currently in no way prohibit using a description to identify a victim, such as saying the victim, the child, the neighbor. And some courts are already doing that, as well as some parties. There's nothing in this rule that would change that. That's still perfectly permissible. Nothing requires that the victim be named. Now, as for the permission to use a pseudonym, as it's more commonly understood in the dictionary definition of fictitious name, There were some concerns, but that's not permitted under current rules. We heard concerns that perhaps that might be viewed as a misrepresentation to the court if a fictitious name is used. So to address those concerns, we wanted the term pseudonym in the rule to make it very clear to parties and courts that, yes, you can use a fictitious name. Likewise, by specifically permitting initials to be used, we wanted it to be clear that although the rule says that you may not use any part of the victim's name, that doesn't mean you're prohibited from using initials.
Well, what is a pseudonym in your mind? Let's say the victim's real name is Samantha Jones. What's a pseudonym?
Well, the pseudonym can really be quite broad in meaning. While the dictionary definition tends to consider it to be a fictitious name, so that might be instead of Samantha Jones, you use Stephanie John, it really can be much more broad than that. And I looked at a variety of case law out there to see how courts view pseudonyms. And courts recognize any number of identifiers as pseudonyms, including victim number one, witness A. My favorite example was unwitting victim. A plaintiff asked permission to proceed under a pseudonym, unwitting victim, in a lawsuit against his ex-girlfriend. The court recognized unwitting victim as a pseudonym, but said, no, we declined to authorize you to proceed under a pseudonym.
I'd like to focus on your first example. That is that Samantha Jones was transformed by use of a pseudonym into Stephanie John. And I say to myself, poor Stephanie John. How many Stephanie Johns are in this state? So that when they wake up in the morning and their name is Googled, now they are the ones that are, it's alleged by your petition, subject to invasion of privacy. Is that really what you want?
We recognize that it is entirely possible that people, as it exists today, there are probably Jane Does in the world. And there are probably a lot of cases that people wonder if it's Jane Doe that they know.
Jane Doe, I think, just like her brother John, are almost terms of art. But Stephanie John is not. And as I understand your response, Stephanie John would be a perfectly acceptable pseudonym for a victim.
Samantha Jones.
Yeah, for Samantha Jones, a victim. And I just pause to think if that's really what you want, and if your definition of pseudonym includes that, is that a problem, the problem that I focus on?
Yes, Justice, I absolutely agree with you. And if it were up to me in a perfect world, no, we would not take that approach necessarily. But one of the issues that the Judicial Council is faced with is the need to work with all the stakeholders in the justice system to build consensus and to build support when we are proposing a rule change. And in our efforts to build that consensus and support, we were respectful of concerns that were raised primarily by practitioners who said that if I can't use a name in my writing, it's not going to flow the same. It's going to inhibit my ability to tell a story. So I need to be able to use a name for people to identify with it and make it read better, flow better. It will diminish the quality of my writing if I can't use a name.
I understand that, and perhaps the Jane Doe is the name to use as opposed to Stephanie John. I understand that concern. Any other state adopted a rule like this? And if so, does any other state use the word pseudonym?
No, actually, this is a very unique rule. I am not aware of any other states that have a similar rule. I honestly wish that there had been, because that probably would have made our drafting efforts much easier. It wouldn't have taken us so long to craft this rule. But in this case, we really were kind of inventing the wheel.
I believe likely most state Supreme Courts, courts of appeal will have a style manual. Now, my brief look at our style manual does not cover this. I was surprised. Dealing with juveniles, it's different, but does not cover this. And I'm just wondering if any style manuals of other courts, style manual being how you're supposed to refer to certain people, or it would include potentially, of course, you know, the form of the opinion and what words that are the recommended words to use. My sense is you probably didn't take a look at that resource. Is that potential resource? Is that correct? I'm not saying you should have. I'm just wondering if you did.
I believe that is correct. Although we did look at generally other jurisdictions' rules of confidentiality to see which terms they used, and there was definitely a lack of consistency.
Is there a style manual, an open document that's readily available?
No, it is not. I was able to request information from it through the Court of Appeals staff attorney.
The example you give in your petition on a pseudonym was if their pseudonym was murder, then you use that pseudonym because it would be valuable in the trial or in the appeal. Is that right?
Actually, Chief Justice, that example was if the victim's name was murder.
Ah,
and,
okay.
It was, for example, a self-defense case, and the victim or the defendant was aware that the victim's name was murder, then perhaps there might be a motion there to seek excusal from compliance with the rule because the victim or the victim's name might be relevant to the issue of
the self-defense. Yeah. Okay. So that's where, but you don't have on motion. It's for the sub four says that you can the court for good cause may make any order. It doesn't say on motion.
Right. And as Judge Blanchard explained, we wanted to keep that very broad. We wanted to give the appellate court broad discretion to enforce this rule or to excuse compliance or to do whatever steps were necessary to make sure that the intent of the rule was carried out.
Well, what about adding the words on motion or sua sponte? And then my other question is, the victim is not a party in our usual rules of criminal procedure. So the fact that a witness might make a motion has issues because you have an outsider, a non-party, all of a sudden intervening by making a motion. The rule doesn't cover that.
Exactly, and that's why we used the language that we did. That's the reason we didn't say on motion. We wanted to leave it broad so that if a victim or a witness wanted to seek the court's protection, that would be permitted under the rule. If the court felt that that was appropriate.
Well, there would be a motion filed, and the court would treat it sua sponte. Is that what you're saying?
The court would have discretion to handle it in any way it chose. We didn't want to make it difficult for the victims or the witnesses or that to be able to avail themselves of the
rule. Nor do I, but on the other hand, the court may or may not see this very promptly. And therefore, you got it on the, you know, somebody files a brief on day whatever, one. The court might not get to that case until we're really rather prompt at the moment, but we may not always be. Might not get to the case for 6 or 8 months, and it's on the internet at that time.
We did discuss that, and that is certainly a concern. But briefs are not text searchable through the commercial search providers like Google or Yahoo. Currently, only the appellate opinions are searchable in those particular databases. So It's a little bit easier to deal with briefs than it is with opinions. Now, obviously, if the name is contained in an opinion, then somebody could Google it, they could get the information, they would easily be able to link back to the court's website where the briefs are posted, and once you're in the court's website, then the briefs are text searchable. But without something to lead them back to that location.
More people look at the commercial stuff and look at our website.
Well, this rule is narrowly crafted to prevent basically the inadvertent discovery of this information. We were very careful to make certain that if someone was actually seeking out information about a case, they still have access to that information. This is not a rule of confidentiality, and we do not want to impact the disclosure of public records. What we're doing here is trying to protect basically someone from accidentally stumbling on information that's not what they were looking for. Right now, if you put someone's name into, for example, a Google search, and they're a victim in a crime and there's an appellate opinion that names them, that appellate opinion is going to come up and it's probably going to be on at least on the first page of results, maybe even within the first couple of results. And one of the examples that was raised was, you know, so many prospective employers use Google as a way to get information on job applicants. And it's amazing how much information you can find out about somebody by just entering their name and running a search. And, you know, for example, if someone entered my name, they would easily be able to find out that I work for the Judicial Council, that I previously worked for the law firm of Taylor Olson Adkins, that I'm an alum of the College of St. Benedict, and they would be able to do some kind of spot checking of my resume through that. But there is no reason that a prospective employer needs to get detailed information about someone being a crime victim and the details of that case. It's not relevant. It's not what they were looking for.
Ms. Southwick, let me ask you a question that relates to the way this court operates. In almost every case pending before us, we have oral arguments. Those oral arguments are almost always shown on Wisconsin Eye. Now, is this going to stop attorneys from using victims' names when they argue before us? Is Wisconsin Eye going to have to strike those names? How far does this rule reach?
No, sir. This rule is very limited to just briefs and appellate decisions and opinions. It would not impact Wisconsin. We would hope that practitioners would kind of take this rule as a subtle hint that perhaps they should avoid using victims' names. But Wisconsin I doesn't come up. You know, if someone verbally speaks a name and Wisconsin I airs it, that's not going to come up in a search. It's not going to be the same level of intrusion. It's not going to be the same level of disclosure of privacy. In that case, that's more analogous to a public records request, because if someone is watching the oral arguments on Wisconsin I, they're doing it because they want information about that specific case. And we don't want to interfere with someone's ability to get information if that's what they're looking for. But again, we're trying to prevent the accidental disclosure of information.
Well, do you think that the next step in the process will be to forbid attorneys arguing before this court to use the names of the victims?
No, sir. I don't see that as a problem because, again, that is information that someone would get if they were deliberately looking for the information about the case. And we don't want to interfere with that. What we're trying to prevent is the accidental going on the internet, running that search, and having that information come back up in writing. You know, that's one of the reasons why we were so careful to not impact the circuit court level, because we recognize that, you know, the right to a fair trial and a public trial is foundation to our justice system. We don't want to impact the information that's disclosed at the circuit court level. And actually what we are trying to protect is a fairly recent development. I don't recall exactly how many years that the court's opinions have been text searchable on the internet through Google and things like that, but it hasn't been all that long. And so basically this rule is in response to a change in procedure, a change in technology that has made this information far more accessible than it ever used to be, or I would suggest even than it was really intended to be. You know, for decades and decades, if someone wanted information about a case, they had to make a public information request to the court clerk, or they had to go and sit in on proceedings. And that's fine. We don't want to interfere with that. That's the way our system works. We have no problem with that. This rule is just in response to a change in the way information is disclosed now and released. And we think that maybe one of the unintended consequences of this is that too much information is being released. And this is a way to kind of put a little bit of a check on that.
So the court, as you know, is looking at putting all our filings on electronically rather than in paper filings. And with the level of hacking that goes on, we're trying to protect everything before we get going, but you never really know what will happen after you get to that point. So how does your rule fit to say Dane County Circuit Court goes on electronic filing 100%? And I know that this is not aimed at the circuit court, and I understand there are other folks are considering that. But if the information is already available there, you know, how is our shutting it down up here really going to have much of an effect?
Well, there are two different ways to look at that. This does not impact electronic filing, because even if the court goes to electronic filing, that doesn't open that information up to the public. That doesn't mean that somebody can, you know, do a Google search and get a copy of the complaint in that case.
It's limited to people who have the right identification to get into the electronic files.
Exactly.
Or like the federal court, where if you pay your dollar, you can get whatever is filed electronically, and that's something certainly that we would have to consider given the cost of electronic filing.
Absolutely. And that is something that we did discuss. And that is one of the reasons that there was a suggestion when we were reviewing this rule that we should make this applicable to all appellate filings, as Justice Bradley suggested earlier. We looked at that, and there was support for that. But at this time, we did have opposition to opening up it up that broadly. In particular, the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys and the State Public Defender, and I think the Appellate Practice Section of the State Bar, all voiced opposition to making it apply to all appellate filings or all appellate documents, because at this point there's no need to do that because all documents are not available.
Well, what impact did they see negatively affecting them if it were opened up for all of them?
Just the fact that there was the big concern about redacting. Does this require us to redact the appendices and things like that? And the committee was fairly unanimous in its position that, no, we didn't want to put that kind of a burden on people that you would have to redact. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I'm not certain what the concern was, other than they felt that that created a rule that was too broad to fit the concern that we were trying to address.
Well, it may be too broad to fit the concern, but they've got to have had a personal interest that underlies that, which is not quite so esoteric. And I guess I was trying to figure out what is that personal interest.
Right, and I would absolutely agree with you. And again, if this was April's rule, I might recommend that we expand it to all appellate filings. But again, we've worked very hard with stakeholders to craft a rule that had a very broad base of support, and it's a compromise to come forward with something. Now, obviously, this court can have the last word, so it would be perfectly fine if you want to make that change. The Judicial Council, I don't think, would have an objection if you wanted to expand it.
What change are you talking about?
To make it apply to more appellate documents.
That would include appendices? I mean, we're talking about all appellate documents. That's an appendix.
Newly drafted documents. There would be a concern about redacting because, for one, it was not our intent to require alteration of documents that were created at the circuit court level. And we do recognize that to require redaction does put a fairly significant burden on the parties.
This is, as I read it and understand it, a limited rule designed to be sure the documents that are electronically available to the public do not have the name of the victim, or in appropriate cases, the witness. Therefore, you don't touch appendices because you say that the electronically appendices are not available on the briefs, only the text of the brief. So what you have here is a very small rule that protects open, publicly disseminated opinions or decisions or briefs, because those are the only things on the Internet. If somebody wants to find out more, they can go to the clerk's office or call the clerk's office of every one of the 72 counties and say, here's my money, send me the full open file or send me the complaint or whatever it is that they can identify the victim with. This rule doesn't cover it because it only covers, in effect, the Internet, because that's where people will look for and find a victim's name or a witness's name.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, agree with that statement of what the rule is intended to do. So any changes here have to be looked at as to the purpose and whether it changes the purpose. And how it fits with the trial court. And that includes this mandatory electronic filing. It's not open to the public. And if somebody wants to get it, I don't know if it's going to be open on payment here or payment to the circuit court clerk.
Ms. Southwick.
We have to watch that. Mm-hmm.
The Internet is bigger than just text searchable documents. So when the chief said that this is a limited rule designed to ensure that documents that are electronically available to the public do not have the name of the victim or witness, I mean, our own circuit court access website has been subject to some debate here. Because there are people who have cases dismissed, people, victims, and others who rightfully don't want their information out there in the public. And it gives a lot of public information to people just when they put in someone's name or a case. And that's Internet accessible. So what I heard the chief say, I thought, was broader than what you were asking for here today, because that would truly impact and potentially shut down or significantly change our circuit court WCCA website that people use all the time. And it has been the subject of significant debate here as to whether it's fair to have all that information out in the public. So is it really as broad as what the chief was just suggesting?
Well, what the chief, if I understood her correctly, what the chief is suggesting is the Internet searchable through an engine such as Google.
Yeah, that's not what she said, so that's why I was trying to bring it back. Because you said the text searchable.
Right. Now, the circuit court access system, obviously that information, you have to go to the circuit court access site, and you have to be looking for court information.
There are a lot of people who think that's too broad in and of itself, because you go on and you find people's addresses. You can get copies of the complaint. You can get when they go to court. You can get if there's a restitution amount ordered. You can get there all sorts of very personal information about someone. And that's not hidden from the public. I mean, that has to be one. But here's my real question. When did things become text searchable? That's a new term to me. And how do you know that in a month or 2 months it won't be text searchable in other arenas and we'll just be behind the eight ball again? I mean, no one wants to hurt anyone's privacy or victimize people more. I certainly don't want to, but I'm trying to figure out how we make this so that we're ahead of the ball and not behind it.
Right. Well, to address the two issues there. First, as far as the circuit court access, there's already a policy that they do not put victims' names on that site.
Well, if you go into the circuit court record, you're going to see all sorts of information that include victims' names and restitution and bond provisions, no contact with blah, 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 and or address at blah, blah, blah. I mean, okay, but it's there.
And, you know, as far as the when things become text searchable, we would need a very sophisticated IT person to be able to explain at what point things are text searchable through those search engines like Google. I do not have enough understanding of that to be able to explain how that happens.
I mean, obviously the court doesn't know that either. Otherwise, we wouldn't have all these opinions out there for years and years and years where someone would be compromised. But I'm just trying to see what's practical but also meets everyone's needs here.
And that's exactly what the Judicial Council was trying to do while we were drafting this rule.
As a follow-up to Justice Ziegler's question, I'm mindful that our own state law library has this continuing project of putting all briefs, scanning all briefs so that they are electronically available and stored. I do not know this, but I think it very possible that in their project they scan the appendices that are part of the briefs. I think there's something going on with the law school also in connection with scanning briefs as a repository. So your rule, of course, sets aside appendices because they are not now electronically available on site. But if my supposition is correct that our state law library does scan them, making them electronically available, how does that intersect, if at all, with your petition here today?
We did have discussions with the state law library and the university. And while they do scan those documents and make them available in an electronic format, they're not text searchable. So the information that they make available, you can't find it by using a search term that would be in that document. You would have to request the brief in a specific case.
Ms. Southwick, as the Judicial Council debated whether or not to come forward with this rule, was there discussion of the First Amendment?
Yes, sir.
Were media people given the opportunity to react to this proposed rule? I know that when Julie Rich sent out notice of this, at least the newspaper association got notice. But there's an awful lot of media that is not tied directly to newspapers. Did they have any input at all at the Judicial Council level?
Not directly to the Judicial Council, but I had several telephone conversations with reporters and with some of the Freedom of Information groups. And they had questions about the rule, but once I provided them with the text of the rule and explained its limited applicability, they did not raise any objections to it with the council. And unless they're here today, I am not aware of any objections that have been raised. As I said, we were very careful to craft this rule to not interfere with anyone's ability to get information about a specific case if that's what they're looking for. We were just trying to avoid accidental dissemination of information.
Available to the justices has been a memo from a court commissioner giving the background of this rule. And one of the statements indicates that in the procedural posture that the committee and judicial council disseminated the proposal to stakeholders and others and got feedback. And the feedback was, quote, mixed. Some supporting and some not supporting. Who was not supporting?
As I said, Wachtel, the Public Defender's Office, and I believe the Appellate Practice Section raised some concerns, although not the concern that they raised to the court about the use of pseudonym. That's something we didn't hear from them about until just prior to the hearing. And their the rule that was disseminated to the stakeholders was a very different version than the rule that's in front of you today. That rule was quite a bit more complicated. It was a more expanded version. It also specifically required the use of alternate identifiers like victim one or pronouns. It didn't give the parties or the courts freedom to use their own discretion to come up with an appropriate way to identify the victims. And so we got a lot of pushback on that, mm-hmm. especially attorneys. They really objected to being told exactly which terms they were limited to using. They felt like that really impaired their creativity and their ability to zealously represent their clients. And so we took those comments under advisement, and the committee spent nearly a year completely reworking the rule to try to adapt it to those comments and alleviate the concerns that were raised.
Is the fault with, and I'm back to this text searchable idea, because I don't fully, I understand what you're saying, but that technology isn't something that I understand. Why are certain things, is the fault with our website that we make things, some things text searchable and some things not? How does that work? I mean, why is it that some documents are text searchable and some documents are not?
And I know that it has to do with the way that the document is electronically created. And as an example, I'm sure that you've noticed that in some PDF documents, you can use the search box up at the top to search, but some of them, it doesn't work. And it just depends on how that document was created and how it was scanned in as to whether or not it's searchable. And I don't know exactly how you create it to be searchable, but I know that there are different ways, and it does have to do with how that document is created.
So would that be a potential answer to just figure out how we deal with how we input the document, if that's the issue? Because these are text searchable, and other exhibits and things are not?
Well, that could certainly resolve this issue, but that is a double-edged sword because there are definite drawbacks to taking away the searchability of those documents. It makes them far less useful for research purposes for lawyers and pro se parties that are using them for research. Then that takes away their ability to search.
Why would someone who is doing research want to search for the victim's name?
Oh, they wouldn't, Justice, but they would perhaps want to search for a specific issue in a case, and you can't remove some searchability and
without removing all of it.
Right, so it would compromise the research purposes.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about subsection 4.
The protective order provision.
For good cause, the court may make any order necessary to protect the identity of a victim or other person. As I understand it, you are contemplating some sort of motion to the court to possibly expand that to witnesses. Is that right?
It could be potentially applicable to witnesses. It could be potentially applicable to family members of the victim. One of the things that when we initially began this project, the committee that drafted the rule, their charge from the Judicial Council was to look at ways to protect crime victim and witness identity. And when this committee began to study the issue more fully, there just was not sufficient evidence out there that we needed a blanket rule to protect the identity of all witnesses. We didn't have the facts to back up that, you know, there was harm going on affecting witnesses in all cases. So we didn't think it was justified to make that an across-the-board rule, prohibition. But we certainly did recognize that in some cases there could be specific issues that made the witness a likely candidate to be protected under this rule. There could be an example of a case where perhaps the witness had suffered some of the same harm that the victim did, but maybe didn't bring a criminal case about it, but was testifying about it, and they'd be entitled to some protection, and they wouldn't want that information on the internet, and they should have the right to ask for protection in that case. Or there could be a witness that might be feel that they were in some sort of physical danger if their name was so accessible on the internet like that, based on what they were testifying about in the case.
Given that the victim's name is all over all the documents in circuit court and often testifies as a witness, of course, in circuit court, did the committee, looking at what the request was for protection, consider just waiting and trying to work with those that are looking at the circuit court to have a coordinated system, if anything, that would meet everybody's needs at all levels instead of bifurcating it out and doing the appellate kind of on its own?
We did, and we actually talked with some of the folks that were working on those rules, and the consensus was that they were two very different problems and that the same rule would likely not be able to address both issues.
So it's not a privacy concern at the circuit court level for the victim?
No, there are very different interests involved in shielding a victim's name at the circuit court level.
Well, I know it would be a different mode of doing it, but is there a different interest? I guess that's what I was wondering about.
Well, there are different interests that would oppose protecting that information at the circuit court
for
level.
Different reasons than
exactly.
At the appellate.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
There are different rights at stake.
I see.
Could I go back to subsection 4?
Yes, sir.
What I don't quite understand is the procedure of who and when, who makes a motion and when it is made. A case, there's been a trial, now there's an appeal. Are you anticipating that individual witnesses will file something with the Court of Appeals? Or how does this work?
In all practicality, no. I am honestly not envisioning that will happen, at least not. I would envision that would be extremely rare. What I imagine would be more commonplace would be that the appellate counsel, in reviewing the transcripts, in reviewing the record, would notice that perhaps there's a very sensitive issue here. And because we have this rule in place, our hope is that will make all involved in this process a little bit more sensitive to what kind of information they're disclosing, and it will just maybe raise awareness a little bit. And as they're looking at the transcripts, if they notice that perhaps there was a child witness that testified to some very sensitive information, they would make efforts to not include that child's name. Or if they felt that opposing counsel might not be as sensitive to that information, they may file a motion with the court asking for a protective order to protect that individual's name. But honestly, I envision that in practice this would be a fairly rare occurrence. But we didn't want to completely discount the fact that there might be a witness that's so concerned. Perhaps they've received threats or something, and they might say, I don't want my name out there anymore associated with this. Please stop using my name. And they would have the opportunity then to come to the court and ask for help.
Okay, now the last part of subsection 4, the court may make an order to excuse compliance with the section. I'm not understanding how this works. Now, for example, I gave a hypothetical before about a public official. Now, I do have the appellate record. In the attack on Mayor Tom Barrett. His name is, it's all over the appellate record, the appellate opinion. Okay. It's almost inconceivable to me that the appellate court would not have used his name. in this case. But I think you're saying that's inappropriate unless the court issues an order saying we're going to use the name. And I don't understand how we get to that order without some sort of motion.
Well, in the case, well, the court could certainly excuse its own compliance with the rule in that case if it felt that the name was necessary to an issue in the case or that the name was relevant to the appeal. And that's why we put that provision in there, because while we had a room full of lawyers and judges racking their brains trying to come up with a really good example where a crime victim's name is relevant to an issue on appeal, there was a lot of struggling and head scratching, and they had a very difficult time coming up with a good concrete scenario where that's relevant at the appellate level. But folks did realize that strange things happen, and there could be the case where the victim's name is relevant. And so we wanted to make sure that there was a provision that would excuse the court's compliance in those cases, where the parties would be free to come to the court and say, I know that this rule exists, but this is part of the issue on appeal. I need to be able to identify this person to effectively advocate for my client. Please excuse me from complying with this rule and allow the crime victim's name to be used.
I understand this rule to be that the identity of a victim would be protected in opinions and briefs at the appellate level. But then when you turn to sub 4, it says the court may make any order necessary to protect the identity of a victim. I thought that was what was supposed to happen under the rule. Well, isn't sub 4 to deal with other people or excusing compliance rather than issuing protective orders to protect the identity of a victim?
Yes, absolutely.
Why is that language in there if that's what the rule is supposed to do from the beginning?
Maybe I didn't quite hear you correctly. Okay.
Well, sub 3 only covers the victim. Sub 4 covers or other person.
Oh, okay. So, for example, I think your question is, why does it say order necessary to protect the identity of a victim? Because we've already protected?
Right.
Okay, exactly. Well, what we did recognize is that in some cases, if the victim had very close family members who were identified, perhaps it might be appropriate to protect the identity of a close family member. If, for example, if a sibling was also identified in the documents, that maybe it would be appropriate, in order to be true to the spirit of this rule, to seek an order to protect the identity of a sibling who may be testifying.
Oh, so it's a further order on top
of the... that the court may be required to protect the identity of more individuals than just the victim in order to protect the victim.
Right. Okay. Now I understand it. Thank you.
Let's say this rule is in place, and the name of the victim is not in an appellate opinion. If I really wanted to know that, I think I would go to CCAP, and I would go to the history of the proceedings in CCAP and see who testified. Could the court issue an order to have that CCAP record changed?
Well, I think the court always has the authority to issue orders such as that. If you know, you have the authority to issue protective orders already. Removing a name from CCAP isn't what we were getting at with this rule. This rule was meant to keep it from being on Google and searchable that way. As I said, our intent was not to limit someone from getting information if they were just looking for information about that case. We were trying to protect the accidental disclosure of that information. So I don't feel that there is any reason to issue an order taking that information off of CCAP. But as I said, CCAP already does have internal policies. Now, certainly things may slip through the cracks, but we did talk with CCAP and we did get a copy of their policies, and their policy is to exclude victim names.
Well, it seems to me the logic of your position would be you really want the identity of victims who testify at trial, as it appears on CCAP, to be identified by initials or something else. Because it seems to me they're, at least for adults, or perhaps sex crime victims, sexual assault victims, I think you're almost always going to be able to get the identity of witnesses and victims by going to CCAP.
Well, and I know CCAP is making an effort to be much more sensitive to these issues and to keep that information off of there. But again, CCAP and the information that's available on the Circuit Court Access site is not what was driving this rule. It's the information that you can get from a Google search that was driving this. If someone enters a term in Google, they're not going to get the CCAP documents. They're not going to get Circuit Court Access documents. Because those, you have to actually go to that website and be looking for court information and do your search from that location. What this rule is driving at is the far more public, far more reaching. Somebody opens up Google, puts a name in, gets this information back. They weren't even looking for anything related to court documents. It just accidentally showed up in the search because opinions are part of that very broad search that those public search engines draw from.
Are there any other questions?
Well, Ms. Southwick, I want to say on behalf of the court that the committee did its homework, as far as I'm concerned. You would explored any number of stakeholders, including the committee of chief judges, which has the trial issue of records, media, the director of state courts and their policy and the CCAP policy. And you and Judge Blanchard have demonstrated today that many of the issues raised by the court have been carefully considered, and you made a decision, as you have to if you submit a rules petition. And not every petition or petitioner is this carefully done. So I do want to congratulate you on that. I was surprised at your answer to Justice Crooks on the media. We used to use initials. Judge Crooks will remember that. And the media asked us to use a name and an initial because when they wrote about the case, it wasn't very interesting to say JC and HC and PQ and et cetera, and that it didn't make it alive, and et cetera. And so we then began to use the the first name with an initial. So they have not appeared raising that here. So we appreciate that, and thank you. And we have several other people who are responding. But my main message is thank you for the hard work, careful work done, and covering the variety of bases that had to be covered here. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I had to
send that message back.
Absolutely. I had a wonderful committee that worked on this project, and I'm very fortunate for all the attorneys and judges that volunteered for Judicial Council projects.
You really did. I think Mr. Weber is next. Are you not? Okay. I have Jill Karofsky.
Well, they're going to go together, I think.
My notes are a little garbled here in order. Which one is it? Okay.
It's a twofer.
All right. You speak in unison or you're out of order.
That's the part I want to see.
Chief Justice, it's great to see you. Thank you for having me here. Members of the court, it's a privilege to be here. My name is Jill Karofsky. I am the Director of the Office of Crime Victim Services at the Department of Justice. One of a number of things that the Office of Crime Victim Services does is we house the Victim Resource Center in Wisconsin. And the Victim Resource Center is one of the places that victims can call if they believe that their rights have been violated or if they're having some problem in the criminal justice system. Usually, by the time we get a call from a victim, they've made several calls or several attempts at the local level before they've reached out to us. I started in the Office of Crime Victim Services in January of 2011, and one of the first things I did was meet with my individual staff members, and I asked them what was going well and what wasn't, and one of my staff members came in and she said, one of the things that isn't going well for me is that I have a victim on the phone just last week who wants to kill herself because her name appeared on the internet as a result of being published in a court of appeals brief. So we started talking internally at the Department of Justice, and we decided that the best place to bring this was to the Wisconsin Judicial Council. And you saw the wonderful work that April and Judge Blanchard under his leadership have done and brought this rule to you. By simply putting this rule on your calendar today, this court has really indicated how important it is for those of us in the criminal justice system to consider ways that we can protect the privacy interests of victims. When we talk about privacy interests, we ask victims to really go through incredible suffering and intrusions in many, many ways of their life. And the invasion of privacy is one of those, but it tends to be the most profound. You often hear victims talk about that their physical wounds heal, but the emotional scarring stays with them. And the re-victimization that a lot of them feel when it's weeks or months or years after a crime has been committed and they're applying for a job, or maybe they have a new special person in their life and that they may get Googled. Someone might look on the internet for their name, and what they find is details of the crime that was committed against them. This rule doesn't do a lot of things. It doesn't remove victim information from the circuit court record, which you've asked some questions about today. It doesn't limit in any way information or documentation that would already be available to members of the public at the clerk of court's offices in our 72 counties. It doesn't direct circuit court judges to do anything differently than they do today. It doesn't alter our open records laws. It doesn't extend to civil cases. And it doesn't infringe in any ways on defendants' rights to have a fair trial or to have a fair appellate process once it gets to the appellate level.
But it does apply to Chapter 980, which are civil cases.
That is the exception. Thank you. Thank you for pointing that out. Absolutely. Absolutely. And the reason that it applies to 980 cases is simply because the way that the definition of a victim attaches to it, someone against whom a crime has been committed, but you're absolutely right. Thank you, Justice Rosenczyk. As you all know, Wisconsin is such a proud place when it comes to the history of victims' rights because we were the first state to pass a Bill of Rights for victims. And one of the things that we've recognized in our Bill of Rights and in our state constitution that we recognize in Chapter 950 is that victims do have this right for their privacy to be protected.
And when I was going through this, it made me think of at the circuit court level how you deal with certain things. And, you know, it's tougher, as you pointed out, for a variety of reasons. And it may or may not make sense to have a distinction here, or maybe this is just the beginning of the toothpaste coming out of the tube. I'm not sure, you know,
to
start
here.
Analogy.
And now I can't.
Later. But there are victim witness coordinators and advocates there to bring it to the court's attention at the outset of the case. And the court regularly asks, has victim rights been complied with? And there's that real feeling that the victim is being heard. It's not that the court has to do every single thing the victim wants, but there is that realization that victim rights are important and the victim needs to be heard. Why shouldn't we have something like that at the appellate level?
So that you would ask, I understand what you're talking about the circuit court level, but so you would ask, maybe we would have a victim witness available?
Be careful what you wish for, but maybe that ought to be your job, to look through these files, and as something comes up, you say, heads up, court, here's a sensitive case, here's the victim's name, you need to be aware of this. So it's not always after the fact wishing, oh, gosh, I wish I would have written that differently, or, oh, boy, we should have thought of that differently. You can head it off from the beginning or at least consider those competing arguments and make a determination like you would kind of at the circuit court level. I mean, there are times victims should be present or shouldn't be present. There are findings the court makes, and then everyone's on the same page as to why this is fair in this instance to deal with it this way.
Right. I think you've touched on a lot of things. I'm going to try to respond to them, but
probably.
I know you'll follow up if I do not. The first thing is I've been doing this work for a number of years when it comes to victims' rights. I actually teach a course at the University of Wisconsin Law School called Victims in the Criminal Justice System, and we're one of the only law schools that has a course like this. And what I found when you're trying to make a change and have people look at things differently is generally taking small steps is better. This opportunity arose because we had the opportunity to work with the Judicial Council, and it made sense to crack this nut first, if you will.
Were you kind of behind bringing this to the council's attention based upon your experience?
Yeah, it was my office that received some of the phone calls that are outlined in the letter that Kevin St. John wrote to the Judicial Commission. And Justice Crooks, this went to your question a little while ago, but Deputy Attorney General St. John laid out three different examples, specific examples for the court, where our office was contacted by either victims, victim advocates, or someone in a victim witness unit in a district attorney's office.
Right. I mean, my point is, instead of being after the fact, it'd be better if we could be proactive about considering these issues instead of after people have been, you know, harmed, right?
Yeah, it would be good.
This isn't new.
It's not new, and the question is, you know, how do you get out in front of it? One of the ways we get out in front of it is simply by having conversations like we're having today. Just in the conversations I've had with judges on the appellate court level, with Justice Blanchard and his colleagues, there's been a change just because they've thought about it differently. Sometimes just getting it on people's radar can make an enormous difference. In the Department of Justice, Mr. Weber can talk to how we very rarely would use victims' names in our filings. We try very, very hard not to. When you're talking about the circuit court level, we're talking to DAs and we're talking internally at the Department of Justice about when do we need to name victims in criminal complaints. So there are a lot of questions about how you get out in front of it. In this instance, it seems like the best way to get out in front of it might be to have a rule so that people do not include victims' names as a rule, and then if there's some reason to have an exception, you ask the court to allow them to have the exception. I would say, in general, in talking to crime victims, I can't think of a crime victim who... And I'm sure there's an exception to this because there always is, but it would be a rarity for a crime victim to want their name on the internet connected with their case. So I feel like it's a pretty fair assumption to say that to have a rule like this is what crime victims would want. There are, when you talk about the rules...
They are on the internet. There's just no question about that. It's all over. I mean, if you go through any case, it's all over in CCAP bond provisions, witness hearings,
yeah,
victim
so
rights compliance,
really
all sorts of things like that. But the issue here seems to be, if I'm getting what Ms. Southwick said, when it became text searchable, then our opinions became more accessible, and then victims' names were out there in the public domain in a different searchable format. And so that really is the impetus behind this particular rule. So it's not, I don't think it's as broad as you're saying. We don't want it on the internet anywhere, although
we'll see where this goes
in a couple of years from now. I won't be one bit surprised if that'll be the next, you know, frontier. But
I think it's searching a name. I don't have a very common name, Jill Karofsky. And if you search Jill Karofsky, and there were a case where I was a victim, it's findlaw.com is where I have seen a lot of these show up. So it's just a public.
So it's something fairly new.
Yes, right. CCAP. I'm glad you brought it up. It's an issue that I've talked to CCAP about because they do have their internal policy that they don't name victims' names. And I have found exceptions to that over and over again, and I've called them and said, there's a victim's name. And then when you talk about victims' addresses, that's really a problem. And so I try to contact them directly, but it's not a perfect system.
Yeah, it might be part of in-court processing, you know, because the clerks sit there and, you know, with their 100 cases that they're doing that morning, they're typing up who's heard and what the bond, and then it's right there. It happens in court. So that's an issue for a different day.
Yes.
What, if anything, can be done for the multitude of victims whose names currently appear in opinions? I am reminded that there's a controversy of who invented the World Wide Web in 1992. But that question, of course, points out that all of this is emerging, and so many of our opinions were written before any opinion was available online of ours. So many of our opinions were written, as Justice Ziegler focuses on, before they were text searchable. And so at the time, the concern was not one that was actualized. They weren't available. So what is to be done for those people who over the years have called your office, who are suffering the unintended indignity? What can be done for them?
It's a wonderful question, and I was wondering if I was going to get that question this morning, and I was going to use the toothpaste is already out of the tube analogy, which has been stolen from me.
But I got to move quickly.
Right. I wish I knew the answer to that. It's something I wonder about, and I wonder about it especially when we have younger victims who are going to live with this longer and longer, and because of the internet, it becomes a place of permanency for information, really. Once something's on the internet, I don't know how you get it off. I'm not sure. There are some victims I know who have changed their name so that they can go forward and have a different name, which really can be asking a lot of somebody. But I don't know how you get it off of the internet, just like I don't know how you would, you know, erase it from the volumes of the Wisconsin reports.
The expungement is a difficult issue. We faced it with expunging arrests, which then never led to conviction or even charges. And people have asked that you expunge acquittals because right. There they are. And the court said, go to the legislature, and they're still talking about this, and a series of bills have been drafted on this topic because it is not easy. So going forward, at least seems easier.
But yes, this isn't a perfect solution, but the intent is to help people in the future. If there's a way that someone comes up with to help people in the past, I'm certainly happy to work for that.
Some people have been charged with criminal offenses and found not guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, the charge has been dismissed before it ever went to trial. In other words, some cases involve completely improvident prosecutions. The records of these cases are on CCAP. There's been tremendous resistance to providing any relief to people whose names are on CCAP. Does your office serve them at all? And how do you distinguish these victims from other victims?
Sure, and that's, that's always when you're working in the criminal justice system, right? It's always about balancing all these interests and everybody's rights. Our office does not, because our office serves people who are victims of crime, and the definition under Chapter 950 is someone against whom a crime has been committed. And while someone who is charged with a crime, and that case may not go anywhere, or they may be found not guilty, they're not a crime under the definition that's provided for us. They're not a victim because of the definition that's provided in the statute.
And that's the definition you use in the proposed rule?
It's close. The language, a natural person, other than a homicide, is not in there, but I believe that the definition that's in Chapter 950 is a victim is a person against whom a crime has been committed. It's an interesting definition, right, because there's no burden of proof with that. There's not, probably or reasonably, but just a person against whom a crime has been committed. If I might just respond to one question that I know Justice Prosser had and someone else may have also had it, and it was, I think when you were talking about subsection 4, the protective order, and it seemed like you were asking maybe some process questions. I do think that a victim could bring this forward because a victim has standing under Chapter 950. I think it's 950.051. A victim has standing to assert a right in a court in which they think their right has been violated. So it might be possible for a victim also to file some sort of motion if they thought that there was something going on at the appellate level where they felt that their right to privacy was being violated. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there another question?
Thank you, Linda.
I want to thank you, Ms. Karofsky, and I've had occasion to discuss the work of your office. Let me congratulate you on the various number of things you have done and how helpful it has been to victims.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much. It means a lot. Thank you.
Well, I guess Ms. Karofsky was 2 and you were 3.
It's working out that way.
Yeah.
Good morning, Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Greg Weber. For the last 26 years, I have been a criminal appellate prosecutor in the state of Wisconsin. All 26 of those years spent at DOJ, all 26 of those years spent in the Criminal Appeals Unit, and the last 13 as unit director. I am accompanying Jill today primarily to answer questions that the court may have about process and practice insofar as the government is concerned in felony appeals in Wisconsin. I also have some general comments that I'd like to start with, and I'd like to grapple, if I can, with some of the questions Justice Prosser asked earlier in the presentations. The court's questions today have tracked pretty much exactly the types of discussions that our committee has had. Let me preface this. I serve as the Attorney General's designee on the Judicial Council. I served with the committee in the process of drafting this proposed rule, but I'm here today in my capacity as an employee of the Department of Justice. The questions have tracked, in essentials, the questions that were raised during the discussions on this particular proposal. I think everybody wants to work toward the same goal, which is the reduction of what the literature calls secondary victimization. Primary victimization of a crime victim is the crime itself. Secondary victimization is the process that follows. And I think everybody is committed to trying to reduce that process of secondary victimization while remaining mindful of the different competing interests that are involved here, and definitely remaining mindful of the fact that this is a narrow aspect of practice. We're focusing solely on appellate side work. We're focusing solely on the content of briefs, judicial opinions that are generated. It can seem very daunting when you think of the entire process, the entire body of paperwork that's generated in the criminal prosecution, and how much of it is victim-centric, how much of it is victim-oriented. We are not going to solve all of those problems today. But what we're asking the court to do is to break off this one discrete area of practice where we can have a difference, where we can make a difference with a minimal impact on what you do professionally and what we as appellate advocates do professionally. The mayor of Milwaukee, that was a good example. We, and I think April said this as well, we tried to come up with scenarios where application of this rule could somehow adversely affect a criminal defendant's ability to properly present issues on appeal. And we came up with lots of fairly bizarre scenarios, but yours I don't think we talked about, and that's probably the one that is most likely to happen. You posit the situation where the mayor of Milwaukee is a crime victim. It's highly publicized. It's difficult to separate out the nature of the victim in that case from whatever issues might be in play in the appeal, and I've been trying to do that. In a situation where the name is absolutely relevant, and I have no clue what the issues are in Gonzales, but let's say in that case a high-profile political figure is the victim of crime. And the issue on appeal is, well, should there be a change of venue? Did the circuit court err in denying a change of venue based on the enormous pretrial publicity that was generated? In a situation like that, I can't envision a criminal prosecutor objecting to a defendant's acknowledgement that, yes, in this case, the victim was a high-profile person, and in this appeal, that is an issue in controversy. In the Gonzales case, the issue might be whether the circuit court erred in admitting hearsay evidence as being to do with the identity of the man as the victim of the crime. And frankly, in the vast majority of cases that I see across my desk in criminal appeals, the victims are not publicly well-known people but for their victimization.
Can the victim consent to having the name used? I mean, take the Barrett example. I mean, why would the mayor have refused to have his name in the appellate court? He comes out the hero.
I don't know. With the rule as drafted, I don't know if the victim could preemptively say, I would like my name to be used. I think a victim could probably not object. And more to the point, this is processed in the criminal appeals unit. Every felony appeal, every blue brief crosses my desk. I give it a read. I assign it to
the cop. Why is your brief blue? Doesn't the color change depending on whether your loss below is blue, meaning you generally win?
Most of the time
we're
respondents.
Yeah.
Most of the time
I just wanted to point that out to everybody.
True fact. Sometimes they're red, sometimes they're blue.
In fact, when it's red, you appeal. You come to the Supreme Court with a petition for review. That's the identity thing. Okay.
Right. I'm looking, though, at the assignments phase. I'm looking at blue briefs. I'm looking at appellants who are appealing their judgments of conviction. And I take an initial read through the brief. And one of the reasons that I am standing here right now is I see many, many appellants' briefs that identify victims in situations where it is not necessary to the issues raised on appeal. Now, whether it is oversight, whether it is carelessness, whether it is a deliberate decision made by the practitioner on the other side, I am in no position to say. But I can tell you that the negative impact on the victims of crime, seeing their names in these documents and in the court's paperwork, seeing their name is a true form of victimization. But I'm looking at, let's say I'm looking at the brief filed by the attorney who's representing the man who assaulted the mayor of Milwaukee. The chances are very good that I would never object. I would never object to a violation of the rule on that ground, nor would the attorney to whom I assign the case. Your question, Chief, if a victim said, I would prefer you use my name, or at least at minimum, I don't care. If a victim were to call me and communicate that, I would take that into consideration. If they were to communicate with Jill's office, I would take that into consideration.
Or communicate with defense counsel.
Less likely, I think, but yes, of course. If a victim of a crime wrote a letter to an appellate practitioner, a criminal defense practitioner, and said, please do not use my name. The only issues on appeal were erroneous exercise of discretion in admitting evidence, and it has nothing to do with me.
Can defense counsel write to the victim and say, we'd like to use your name, do you object?
Could a defense counsel do that? Probably. Would a defense counsel do that? I think it unlikely.
Counselor, you know, do you perceive this rule as creating a right in victims not to have their name used in the documents we talked about?
I don't think a victim would possess a preemptive right under the way that this rule is written. That said, I think Jill's point is a valid one. A victim has standing to be heard in a proceeding.
Right. I guess my question goes back to Chapter 950, which is the rights of victims and witnesses of a crime. And I'm just wondering, I mean, if we are to create the presumption that you don't use the names of victims, that's something that wasn't available before this rule. And I'm wondering if it doesn't maybe belong in Chapter 950 rather than in the Supreme Court rule. Did the committee talk about that at all?
I believe we did talk about where it was going to be cited, if it was going to be part of the Chapter 950 statutory scheme or something separate in the rules of appellate procedure. Mm-hmm. I will say this. I have done a fair amount of research in this area. I've provided some of that to Commissioner Rich. Other states do have different statutory provisions for different stages of criminal proceedings that provide certain privacy rights, the use of a pseudonym, the use of a nonspecific identifier. Sometimes they're found in the family code, sometimes they're found in the appellate code. Some of those statutes are cited in the paperwork that I've given the commissioner. I think at the end of the day, it really is a matter of simply having an eye for detail, paying attention to what is written. I just filed a brief in the Court of Appeals personally last week in a case involving a reckless homicide where it would have been the easiest thing in the world to use the name of the victim. I chose not to. Personally, I have used pseudonyms in briefs that I filed in the Court of Appeals, possibly in your court. I don't recall, but I know for sure in the Court of Appeals. Victor, Victoria, V, because I'm old school when I'm taking notes and reading a record. Pi is the state, the plaintiff, Delta is the defendant, V is the victim. I almost always choose Victor or Victoria, depending on gender. Personally, I find the use of initials bloodless writing. I have talked to enough appellate judges and justices to get the feeling that most of them would prefer having a proper name to assign to a victim, even if it is a pseudonym. I've been told that appellate courts, I have it on rumor that appellate courts read thousands of pages of briefs every month, tens of thousands a year. I want my writing to be persuasive. I want my writing to stay with you for good reasons. And if using a pseudonym accomplishes that, I'll do it. The rules currently don't prohibit it. I was waiting to see if the Court of Appeals in the case I was describing was going to remark on it. They didn't. But they also wrote a decision that identified the victim in the case neutrally.
I want to go back to my question about Chapter 950. When I asked it, I was looking at it from two perspectives. One, whether this is really a substantive
change, which we don't do, as you know, right, by rule. The other part was if I were a victim and I were wanting to see what kind of rights I have in this provision that you're giving to us as a Supreme Court rule, we're in Chapter 950, it might be more accessible to those folks that aren't schooled in the law but might want to know what their rights might be.
In this, and this court, I think, at different times in its rulemaking process has indicated when a petition comes before it that it's more appropriately a legislative function rather than something that the court can do in rulemaking.
Well, I know even if you were to say, no, this is just procedural, there's no substantive component, that's a separate question. But looking at it from the perspective of the victim, and maybe it's a better question for Attorney Karofsky to answer, would they find it easier in Chapter 950 if we're trying to accommodate their needs?
I think that's a very good question. And generally, of course, victims aren't looking in the statutes, but we do have, there are a couple stages in the process where they're supposed to be informed of their rights 24 hours after contacting law enforcement, and within days of charges being filed in the district attorney's office. If I'm remembering correctly, and this was a two-year process, I think that one of the concerns also was to have it in this part of statutes because that's where the practitioners were going to look. Mm-hmm. When I was making reference to 950, I was referencing the fact that victims have a right to privacy that's supposed to be protected. Mm-hmm. Your point is well taken. There are a lot of rights in Chapter 950, and so I think that if this were a rule and if it stayed in 809-86, which is well outside of Chapter 950, there certainly would be plenty of time for someone to let victims know that they did have this right. And it isn't one of the rights where the victims have to do something. And some of the other rights, they have to do something. They have a right to a victim impact statement, but that right doesn't do them any good if they don't draft a victim impact statement. And this is a right that happens without them having to take action themselves.
Okay. Well, first of all, this is set up so that it would comply with changing the statute or an SCR because we've had the hearing and we've had appropriate notices. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I didn't hear what you said. It has the effect of...
This complies with 751.12.
Oh, yeah. Right, which is the court's ability to make rules...
That's right.
In the statute.
Whether it's in the SCR or in the statutes. So that's been taken care of. So the only issue is whether you change the number. And that can be accomplished also by a cross-reference.
Well,
if it's in 950, a cross-reference to 809, or if it's in 809, a cross-reference to 8.
Absolutely. Sure.
950. As a matter of fact, I thought that Julie Rich, in her comments to the court, wanted a reference to 950 so that and to the victim's constitutional and statutory rights. Was that in the original? C, Wisconsin Constitution, Article 1, Section 9, and 950.01. So there's a reference here in the comment. But that's one of the issues. Mm-hmm. Do you put out a manual or a booklet for victims?
Several. Yes. Our office has several publications. We do have one that just outlines their rights.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also work with the counties, the victim witness unit in each of the district attorney's office, and help them with the materials that they supply for victims.
And would you add this to that?
Or, yeah, absolutely.
Let me follow through with that. Let's assume that everybody recognizes this as a right of mm-hmm. a victim. Now the right gets violated. An attorney... makes a mistake and uses the name in a brief. The court makes a mistake and uses the name in an opinion. Is the attorney subject to a lawsuit? Is the court subject to a lawsuit for violating the right of the victim?
Right. I don't believe so, Justice Crooks. The remedies for a violation of the rights in Chapter 950 also appear in Chapter 950, and it's the two-step process. The first process would be that a victim would contact the Victim Resource Center in the Office of Crime Victim Services at the Department of Justice and talk about how they believe that they're having some issue with the criminal justice system. It may or may not be that a right is violated. They're not always sure when they call us. And the first thing we try to do is work with them and work with whoever they have the problem with. And 90-plus times out of 100, we're able to take care of things at that. Usually it's a communication issue. The DA hasn't issued the charges yet, and the victim doesn't know why. And if you can marry those two and they can have a conversation, the victim can understand why, and the problem goes away. But if that doesn't happen, then the victims have the right to go to the Crime Victims' Rights Board. And there are several remedies under the Crime Victims' Rights Board, available to the Crime Victims' Rights Board. One, they can just do a report and recommendation, which is to say that we had this problem and this is how we suggest the system handle it in the future. They may make a referral to the Judicial Commission. They have the ability to do a private and a public reprimand.
If they made a reference to a judicial commission, that would be an ethical complaint against the judge, right? I mean, that's what you take to the judicial commission.
Yes, and that's what, it's just one of the remedies. I'm just listing off the remedies available to the crime. Yes, I mean, the other remedy that's available to them is to go to a circuit court and ask that a $1,000 forfeiture be issued for an intentional violation. The law has been in effect since the late 1990s, and no one in the state has ever been, that the $1,000 fine has never been imposed, but attention.
I always thought I had judicial immunity for any decision. Right, wrong, or indifferent. I hope that hasn't changed.
Hey. Are we really talking about this today? It's Greg.
You touched, Justice Crooks and Justice Rogensack both touched on a point that I wanted to emphasize. We would train around any change in the rule, whether it's cited in Chapter 809 or Chapter 950. The Department of Justice has a principal training mission to advise and consult with district attorneys. The DAs handle the misdemeanor briefing that the Court of Appeals sees on a daily basis. We would train them in compliance with this rule. It's a little easier task at the felony level because I can impose my force of personality on my attorneys to write briefs in compliance with the rules. And in principal part, we do now. We do not.
Occasionally, someone from the district attorney's office appears here and files a brief. Do you check those briefs?
If we're asked to, we become involved. We generally take over the misdemeanor cases that come before the court. We're less likely to take over traffic cases if the district attorney is much more familiar with the case than we are. We generally don't come into juvenile cases quite so quickly. In some of the cases where the county is the party in interest and the DA represents the county, we're not involved at all. But I routinely take telephone calls from district attorneys who are briefing cases, who are in various states of angst over what they have to do. And we would, of course, train around that, as I'm sure my colleagues in the state public defender's office would as well. Both of those institutions have significant training components.
Mr. Weber, you said that the committee considered hypotheticals, not the mayor of Milwaukee, but
not the mayor.
What about police officers as victims?
As crime victims? In a situation like that, I might very well identify the victim simply as Police Officer X or Police Officer Victor. If the nature of the officer's job title is an integral part of either the facts of the case or has a bearing on an issue in controversy, I would not object to an identification. I doubt that the officer would as well. If necessary, we could use a pseudonym or a nonspecific identifier.
Well, I'm thinking of a case, State versus Payano.
Gunshots through the door. Right.
Ayano's gunshot hit and wounded Officer Lutz. Officer Lutz testified, and there's a long piece of testimony. And in my opinion, I wrote, Officer Lutz suffered severe damage to his left arm. His injuries required 3 separate surgeries, leaving him with very poor muscle strength in his arm. Officer Lutz was unable to return to active duty because of his injury. Really, what I'm inferring from this rule is that you believe that all of this was improper.
I believe that neither of us really can gauge the effect on Officer Lutz to read again and again, perhaps, a detailed description of his victimization. Perhaps that's different because of the position he holds, and I would have to think about that, but I think I could probably write that same paragraph in an advocacy piece that I submit to the court without using his proper name and still write it persuasively. I think the court could write that paragraph persuasively, but protecting his identity, if that were a requirement of the rule. I'm not worried so much about the police officer who's identified by name. I'm worried about the bartender. I'm worried about the woman who's held up at 1 in the morning while she's closing down a bar and is victimized and reads her name when she goes to the website for the court or goes online and sees her name again and again. Or another employer, a future employer, finds that out and does God knows what with that information. Some crime victims, by virtue of their employment, virtue of their title, may surrender a right of privacy, and possibly reasonably so. But this rule's not written for the police officers. It's written for the bartenders. It's written for the babysitters. It's written for the child sexual assault victims. And I choose those because I've seen briefs where people who were victimized like that were identified by name gratuitously. There's no need for it. And as I said at the beginning, and I'll close with this, I don't know if it was oversight on the part of the appellate advocate. I don't know if it was intentional. I don't know if it was malicious. But it was there. It was there. And it really, really doesn't need to be. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weber, and thank you, Ms. Borofsky. And next person is Talisa Dickenor. Did I pronounce your name correctly, ma'am?
Good morning. My name is Talisa Tishner.
Sure. Thank you.
And I'm here to speak for the victims and the rights for privacy, as I am a victim of a crime. Federal and state laws. They found him guilty, was arrested, charged, convicted, and sentenced. I am a victim. That day, he decided to put a pillow over my head to try to suffocate me. He took a knife to my throat. He stabbed me in my chest. He took, as I thought, was an old frying pan and hit it over the back of my head. Later hours, I found out it was a kitchen chair. He also took me to the stairs. I lived in an older home, and the stairs went straight down. He chose to shove me. My feet did not touch any of the steps. I flew into the wall. I fell back into the steps and went unconscious for a few minutes. As a victim, I had to stay alive. I had to figure out a way to get out of there. Unfortunately, I couldn't figure out a way because it was dark. He took the speaker wires. He took any wires he could possibly take out of the home and tie me up. He left me there to die. I thank the Lord today that I got out. My neighbor calls at 911. ambulance showed up, finding out that he took my car, finding out that he took money from me. I was in the hospital and had to go under emergency surgery to find out if he had cut anything else that was in my throat. I thank the Lord that there was nothing else that he had done to me besides what was in my head at this point. Scared and unknowing if they had caught him because he was on the run. This gentleman went to prison for 5 years. He got 5 years extended supervision for what he has done to me. You talk about CCAP. If you look my name up in CCAP, does not show any of the case whatsoever. If you look his name up, my name is there. I have asked numerous times to have my name taken off. They did. Only to have something else happen in the case, and my name gets put back on again, which I will be going back through and asking them to remove it as well. This happened in 2002. In 2008, he chose of his rights to appeal his case. His appeal was on the judge did not say whether he could testify or whether he could not testify. The appeals court denied his appeal. At this time, in 2008, I Googled my name. My name shows up in a search. The Supreme Court of Wisconsin, www.wicourts.gov, shows up. My name is attached to it. State versus the gentleman's name. Case law, findlaw.com, Wisconsin Supreme Court. My name is attached to that. There's also a front sheet on there that has my initials. Only, but it is attached to my name. There's also a judicial view, state cases, Wisconsin, criminal justice, which is also attached to my name. Now, these things that are attached to my name, if you open them up, some are PDF files, some are just files. It will give you step by step of what happened. That doesn't have anything to do with the appeal. It will tell you everything. And not only is my name attached to it, my minor daughter's name, initials, are attached. It also states in there what happened to her. So anyone that just wants to Google my name, jobs, anyone, can find out what has happened to me and my daughter. I ask that this rule gets put into place to help us victims be more private. There are a lot of gray questions that are coming up, and I do understand that. But as a victim, I support this rule 100%. This will help the victims to come forward and to be able to talk about what happened to them, even if it is at a court level, knowing that down the road, the defendant can appeal his case and know their information is going to be kept private.
If you were looking where to find this right, or if you were telling a friend where to look to find this right, do you know anything about the rights of victims that are contained in our statutes?
I know that if you Google victims' rights, there are certain things that do come up that you can search.
Okay.
I'm not a profession.
No, you know, I understand that. I was just trying to think where it would be more helpful to people that have been victims. Would it be more helpful in Chapter 950? Or this rule we're here today is about how you put together an appellate document. It's something that victims would tend not to be using, the practitioners would tend to be using. So, you know, I was just kind of wondering from your perspective where it would be best to put it.
But I would guess it would be up to the courts to figure out what ruling it would want to go into. But I'm not really familiar with the 95 that you're speaking of.
That's Chapter 950. Well, Ms. Karofsky is.
Okay. But I do know there is a rule that needs to be set forth for the victims.
Right.
so this does not happen to them. I don't really want to see this happen to another victim. You know, it was devastating to see my name connected to the case, and know that family members can look it up and read everything that was said, even though they weren't in the courtroom. That's all on there. It's very devastating, and you know, I would like to get past what has happened. But with this being on the internet, I'm constantly looking and wondering, you know, the job applications am I applying for? Are they looking? People that I work with, are they looking my name up? I mean, everybody's human, and everybody, you know, does like to look things up on the internet. And, you know, are they going to judge me? You know, are they going to have questions and come forth? I mean, I have had a couple people ask me about it when it first came out in 2008 on the internet. It's something I really don't like to talk about. You know, I would like to get past that.
Thank you.
Have you talked to other victims who have had the similar experiences that you've had? In other words, people who had their cases appealed and ended up with the names being used in appellate briefs and appellate opinions?
I have not. As a victim, I did try to get involved more so to speak with victims, to help them through processes and maybe kind of help them along the route. But because I'm dealing with my own, it's kind of hard for me to do that. But eventually, I would love to do that.
When you were at the circuit court, was there a victim witness advocate or a victim rights advocate that you were able to work with there?
There was.
And at the appellate level, I mean, I come back to that idea I had before when they were talking, you know, that might be a very practical way to assist victims as well, to have a similar victim rights advocate that might bring things to the court's attention.
I believe during the time that I was going through this, the advocate that I had an overload. Of files that they were dealing with. I feel they gave me the basics. I reached out as much as I could to the court level and ended up going through Madison's because of the fact that they have so many that they're dealing with. I wasn't really getting more so one-on-one with them. I do feel I was left out with some of the things that I should have been told and wasn't. But, you know, it's I'm here today for victims, and I want to speak on their behalf to help them understand that their privacy will be protected.
Thank you.
Ma'am, do you have a victim witness advocate here today with you?
I do. I actually have two. I have Rachel and then April. I've been working with April, and they've both been wonderful.
Good. And the victim witness advocate comes from what office? Is it the Dane County office?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
I'm sorry. I want to know whether the advocate is affiliated with a particular DA's office or with Ms. Karofsky's office.
It was out of Rock County where the case was.
Rock County.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. So that they provided assistance for you today.
Yes, ma'am.
And I should tell you that I want to congratulate you on your appearance and your testimony. It's not easy for lawyers to come here or judges. Having been here as a lawyer, I can tell you that from my own personal experience, but the others will tell you. And for someone not trained in the law who has every right to appear in court, it is especially difficult. And as a victim who's objecting to having been named, that adds to the difficulties, and you've done a wonderful job, and I appreciate your coming.
Thank you.
It's, yes.
She's next up, I think.
Tell me who you are.
I will.
Good idea.
My name is Rachel Monica Wilcox.
I've got, we've got two more people who have registered to appear. You, Ms. Wilcox, and Ms. Hennick. But it is noon, and we ordinarily take a break for lunch. Can you come back at 1:30?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Hennick, can you come back at 1:30? Okay. Then I will call for a break and have the court will reconvene at 1:30. We will hear from Ms. Wilcox and Ms. Hennick. Did you get any other names? Okay. And anyone else who wishes to register? We are in recess for lunch.